Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us again on the Inspire Health Podcast. And we are continuing on with the series on life, death, and beyond, exploring our greater reality. And today we have Neil Douglas Klotz. And when I came across Neil's book, which is this one here, one of many, but this one particularly, I thought this was really timely for this series. And this book is called Revelations of the Aramaic Jesus, The Hidden Teachings on Life and Death. And Neil's a renowned writer, teacher, artist in the fields of Middle Eastern spirituality and the translation and interpretation of the ancient Semitic languages of Hebrew, Aramaic, and Arabic. Living in Scotland, he was for many years the co-chair of the mysticism group of the American Academy of Religion. He has written several books on the Aramaic spirituality of Jesus, as well as native Middle Eastern spirituality, Sufi spirituality. And then I thought this was really fascinating, Neil, that you also edited four collections of the work of Middle Eastern mystic Khalil Gibran, who I just love his work too. So you've got such a beautiful, eclectic way of, I think, deciphering a lot of these messages from whether the mystics or from Jesus himself. And I thought this is just going to be fascinating to have a conversation with you, literally to try and pull in what were the perspectives from Jesus on life and death and how we can live a more beautiful life. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Taya. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I think this will be really fun. So maybe you can start off with just give us a little bit of a background on yourself and how you came to be so interested in this area. I mean, this is really quite a niche area to focus decades of your life on.
I thought so too, actually. No, I was raised hearing different languages in my birth family, not Aramaic, but German, Polish, Yiddish, Russian, a bit of Russian. And of course, I was raised, I shouldn't say of course, but I was raised in the U.S., in one of the suburbs of Chicago, but my family was sort of multilingual, and my father, as you know, was a chiropractor. So my parents were already into what we now would call alternative health. And then in addition, although we were sent to more or less traditional religious Protestant schools, my parents were really not that interested in traditional religion. They were more interested in the work of Edgar Cayce, the American mystic. And then they were interested in Rachel Carson, one of the early, you know, pioneers of the ecological movement. So this is what I was raised with. And, when I went to, fast forward, when I went to university, I sort of shrugged off all of the religious upbringing that I got through school, and having to memorize large parts of the Bible and theology and all of that stuff, and just went on, sort of a search for what really mattered. Again, fast forwarding a bit, I ended up being an investigative journalist when I came out of university and was working in New York City on a consumer protection publication. But I was very dissatisfied, not with what I was actually doing, which was trying to uncover what was really the truth about the food and the drugs and all of these things that were pervasive in culture, even in the 1970s, which is when I was working. And I had sources in the Food and Drug Administration and all the things that you do. But as a young man, I was very idealistic, and I wanted to tell people positive things that they could do to help themselves. Now, of course, that would be a no-brainer, but my editor was telling me, "No, Neil, you're doing good work, but you need to make people more afraid, because only fear sells." And this was in 1973.
Well, not much has changed in that regard.
Not much has changed, and in fact, it's gotten more so. Whether you look in print publications or internet or whatever, social media, it's all gone, more in that direction. And so I was interested. I went to work for an alternative news service for a while, and then I burnt out because I was telling people all this information. But, there wasn't much change really happening. And I sort of reached an early burnout in my late 20s and went on a spiritual search. And this is where I ended up finding chanting. I was working with the Sufis. And because I had editing and writing skills, I was editing the diaries of the person who started the Dances of Universal Peace, whose name was Samuel Lewis. And Samuel Lewis said he wanted to learn how, before he died, he wanted to learn how to pray the Lord's Prayer in Aramaic. Mm-hmm. But he had died and he hadn't done that. So I decided, well, if he thinks it was important, maybe there's something there. So that was how I went down that rabbit hole, basically. And I began just chanting what I could find of Aramaic without really knowing much about it, and began having rather profound spiritual experiences. But after that, then I was, having met Matthew Fox later, Dr. Matthew Fox at the Creation Spirituality University where I was working, Matt encouraged me to learn Aramaic properly, which I did, and then I began to write books and try to bring the spiritual and the intellectual together in those books, which began with the book Prayers of the Cosmos. Mm-hmm. So that's in the nutshell how I started. And then I thought, well, that's enough, you know, Aramaic, you know, who wants to know about it? But surprisingly, Prayers of the Cosmos took off and still actually is going. So
I think why it probably is taking off too is I feel like in a lot of ways people are getting, I think, more and more open to just wanting to understand the greater reality better. And what I've kind of found is, even, you know, growing up through going through Protestant United Church, and I generally all had a really good experience with it, but I remember even hearing different passages, and some would land for me in a certain way, and other ones I couldn't quite grasp what it really meant, or it actually felt off. You know, sometimes it would I would feel a strong sense of like judgment or something, and that didn't really resonate with my concept of divinity, even as a child. And yeah, so I think when I was going through your work and reading it, there's a lot of expansiveness to the message that I think is probably landing for people in a way that is tangible. You know, it's like you can feel it a little bit more. It makes it real. And so that's kind of where I'd love to jump into. I mean, you said a lot of things there too. Even before you were talking about your experience being an investigative reporter, it's tricky, you know, trying to figure out, you don't want stuff to be landing where it's only fear, but you're wanting to bring a certain level of awareness, but without it being then completely tethered to a fear response around everything. It's it's a tricky dynamic, trying to bring information and then being able to have people sort of hold it in a place of neutrality to then see what their internal instructions tell them to do with it without being so tied into fear response. So
yeah, agreed. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
All right, so maybe we'll start with, what is Aramaic? Because I think a lot of people might not be so familiar with it. And why is it so helpful to specifically view the teachings from Jesus from that Aramaic lens? What makes that unique?
Well, Aramaic, not aromatic, but Aramaic, one is the common spoken language of that area at the time that Jesus lived. So it was his native language. And it was the native language of, well, all of his listeners, all of the common people at his time. Although that area of what's now called the Holy Land or Palestine, Israel, parts of Syria, they were under Roman domination at the time. Only those who were collaborating with the Roman Empire would have spoken any Latin or Greek. So the language is important in that Aramaic is an ancient Semitic language, like ancient Hebrew, like ancient Egyptian, and others. Classical Arabic was mentioned. And they have an entirely different worldview. So it's not just about the grammar and the words and the meaning of words, but it's about the way that people at that time viewed life, viewed the world, viewed the nature, viewed each other, and viewed reality. And that is very, very different from the way it came to be, and which is the way most of us in Western culture have inherited. So that's really it.
So what was the, when we think about the worldview back then, if we kind of go back in time, to that point in time where Jesus was there and actually speaking, what was the worldview at that point? And I guess, how is it different now? And are the teachings relevant in the same way or even more so for us now?
Yeah, I mean, here are just a few bits that I usually tell people. Aramaic does not have a split between the inner world and the outer world. That means that the same preposition that means within, as in within me, is also the preposition that means among, that it, or between, or among us. So this inner-outer split, that my thoughts, feelings, emotions are only mine and don't affect anything in my world, or that my world does not affect that. It's like, just here's my private inner world. And this did not exist at that time. Again, Semitic languages come from a nomadic background when people pre-agriculturally, before agriculture, they were just traveling, and they felt embedded with their environment and with their tribe and with everything and, you know, with all of that. So in addition, there isn't a split between what's sacred or spiritual and what is, you could say, earthly or secular. Those concepts don't exist in the ancient Semitic languages. You don't have like God up there or the goddess or whatever, and me down here, poor me, stuck in my body. So there's no denigration of the body or of embodied life or of earthly life. That's just as sacred as everything else for Aramaic. You don't have this sacred profane split. In addition, there's no split between the past, present, and future, really. Or you could say that they are continuum that are in process. If we look at it simply, it's as though I'm in a nomadic caravan and the ancestors are traveling ahead of me. And so this aheadness, they started the caravan, I'm following in their footsteps. That's the past ahead of me. And here I am, I'm traveling. The ancestors are still traveling. I just don't see them. They're in the unseen realm. They've gone to the, you know, to the unseen. And then my ancestors, my children, children's children, they're traveling too, but they're behind me. I don't see them yet because they're not born. So the next generation and the next generation, they're behind me and also traveling. So you have this continuum. And there's a great sense of responsibility. What I do is going to affect those coming after me. What I do is going to affect those coming after me. Now, who do I choose to follow in terms of my ancestors that are traveling ahead of me? Well, I want to choose the best ones, don't I? I don't want to choose the people who went off. And so I get a choice as to who I follow or, you know, whom I follow. And that's an important choice to make, because there are still choices to make every moment. So these are huge differences for Yeshua, for Jesus. Yeshua is his Aramaic name.
Mm-hmm. I think that's so beautiful, and that really, I mean, that's even reminds me of the way we would see even some of the different Native American cultures, the way that they would view stuff. A lot of times they would talk about, you know, you're doing things for seven generations in the future as well. And what's also really neat is it's like that concept is really being rebirthed again, I think, through like quantum physics and sort of this concept of metaphysics too. It's like we are sort of seeing our worldview is changing to being this much larger perspective of almost like a unity model in some capacity. And you're kind of getting both pieces. I think it's like lots of separation, then lots of this other perspective too. And I feel like that's kind of where we are right now, is trying to figure out what resonates with you and which direction do you kind of want to focus on. But I think that's all really beautiful. And it does, it completely changes. I know even just from when you were not a parent to when you become a parent, it's almost like just that perspective where you know that what you're doing is not just about you anymore. It's kind of about very, very real dynamic with your kids. There's a change in that. This is sort of taking that to sort of the next nth degree, I think, around how our actions influence not just ourselves, but everything around us. The Inspire Health Podcast will be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Start your day the right way with Revive Active's range of super supplements and get the most out of life. Take one power-packed sachet mixed with water and enjoy a super tasty health drink at work, at home or on the go. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to optimize your health and well-being to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health and more. No filler, no stimulants, no artificial colors or preservatives, just the right mix of vitamins, minerals, amino acids, and hero ingredients to help you put back what life takes out. Try our 7-day or 30-day boxes and use code UKRADIO to get a free supplement shaker. Revive Active, super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yes, I mean, we've sort of lost that over the last 5 centuries or so. But we can consciously choose those things now. You could say what came naturally to us as human beings in our consciousness 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, it's a long history. What came naturally in terms of this embeddedness, or what Thich Nhat Hanh calls an interbeingness, this we can reclaim this part of our heritage with our own heart, with our own choices and all of this. And this is really one of the major messages that Jesus comes with, really.
That's really interesting. In a conversation that we were having with Kathy O'Brien, she spoke about the forces that have tried to control global societies have known that if they can control and set into place certain things for 3 generations, then at that time onward for generations coming, it's just going to be automatic. That's just going to be what they know, how they function, how they perceive the world and their reality. And when we were speaking with Paul Selig, the guides had spoken through him that the change that we're in, the shift that we're in, is essentially going to be taking place within 4 generations. But what's really interesting in the conversations that we have amongst ourselves and hearing you speak of it, if we are more conscious of where we are right now and the choices that we make and the perception and the lens that we have on, then we can actually accelerate the changes that we want to ultimately see within our world now on a moment-to-moment basis.
Yes, I agree perfectly, Taya. The shifts in consciousness, we'll call them that quite simply, that each of us does is extremely important. And they will not appear on a graph. They will not appear in any quantifiable form, in a statistic, in a journalistic report, in anything like that, because that's not that whole outerness where you count numbers and it's all about the material existence and about the news headlines, that degree of outerness is all that's recognized by Western science or Western journalism or even most of Western history. very few people talk about a history, evolution of consciousness, which is really what we're talking about. And it's a theme I sort of emphasize again and again, even when I'm talking about Jesus or, you know, Aramaic and what all these different Bible passages mean. The notion of the evolution of human consciousness is extremely, extremely important. We cannot presume that people 2,000 or 20,000 years ago looked at reality, they had the same consciousness that we do. It wasn't. It absolutely wasn't. And anyone that's interested in this, they can read Théo de Chardin or Owen Barfield or a lot of other people who were early in this field and have noted this. And there's a lot of this in my new book relating it to Yeshua. Because Yeshua comes at this particular time when human consciousness is clearly becoming more self-oriented, that is, more me-oriented. And now 2,000 years later, we see sort of the almost the nth degree of that, where it's all about me, 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 me. So Jesus is showing, okay, yes, you have an individual self, but here's what you can do with it. Here's what you can do with it. You can choose to be connected, to be connected to the unseen realm, and you can choose to be connected to each other, to nature. And these are very, very important teachings that he gives us.
Neil, from your perspective, why did we start to become so disconnected from that over this time period? What are some of the reasons why we have kind of lost that? I mean, even from a perspective, I think of nature, our concepts with nature have dramatically changed. You know, because even when you talk to me about originally coming from a chiropractic family, I know when I've talked to old school chiropractors and old school naturopathic doctors, I mean, I feel like within that was a reverence for nature, an understanding of our multidimensionality of being a physical, mental, emotional, spiritual being. All of these things intersect. You know, those were really ingrained philosophies. And then, but it definitely, there's been more and more of a separation. From your perspective, what are some of the things that cause us to be more separate from that? And then what is the path to start to reconnect back to it?
Okay, well, now we get down to it, Jason. So, I mean, these are very important questions. They may be the most important questions. I know, you know, chiropractic, you know, early chiropractic at least, had this notion, and many other natural modalities, healing modalities do, that the body has its own wisdom, it has its own intelligence. And so if we just orient the body correctly to its surroundings, to itself, to nature, then it will heal itself. And this was, you know, this was an intuition that comes later to many natural alternative remedies, but it was a normal human notion at that in the earlier times, in the times 5 or 10,000 years ago. That's very clear. Now, in answer to your question, it seems to me that it was necessary that the human self develop. And by the human self, I mean the individual sense of myself, of the I, of the me in the world. Whereas before, and here I'm leaning on some of the authors that I mentioned, we were embedded in the natural world, but there was very little sense of a separation between me and the natural world. As I mentioned, this inner-outer split, barely there, not really there at all. It's like a transparency. So that when I look at a tree, for instance, I see not just the wood or the branches, but I see sort of a spiritual being, if you will, all together. And so what we would call today my outer life is really much more like what today is my dream life. You know, I'm taking a pause there just so people can sit with that. So it's like I was wearing my subconscious on the outside, if that makes any sense. But again, that's almost a koan. This is how different things were from the way we look at life today. So fast forward, the human self develops the sense of separation, I from you, I from nature, me and above and below and all of this. And so we're constantly trying to reclaim these connections. Connect, 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 connect through different ways, natural healing remedies, through alternative spiritualities. You know, all of this, these are conscious choices that we're making. Why? So that we develop our will, our heart and our will. So the human individual heart and will is developing. And you could say, well, but look at all this stuff going on around us. I'll use the polite word. You know, how is that part of any natural, divine, or otherwise, you know, evolution? But, you know, this is, I suppose, so that we can look out and see, well, you know, that choice was pretty poor, wasn't it? And we need to stop making that choice. But the impetus for it was to, you could say, again, using the terms that Jesus would have used, that myself, what he calls nafsha, my individual breath in this body, wants what my soul, my rucha, the breath that is everywhere and all of the time connected, already has. You could say this breath that is the fully connected breath from before my birth and that will continue after my so-called physical death, this self, this sort of soul already has everything. It already possesses everything. So, but myself wants to go out and try to, okay, I want to grasp this. I want to get that. I want to get this. I want to own this and do that and control nature and, you know, dominate this and have a war here or whatever. So, you know, these are still, you know, parts of that same evolution. They're just not playing out in what Yeshua would call a ripe manner, R-I-P-E. That is, they're not playing out in a timely, appropriate, blessed way.
You know, Neil, when you were talking about that we were very much absolutely entwined with nature originally, I've done a fair bit of work in something called biogeometry, which was really fascinating by Dr. Ibrahim Karim. And I've done some trainings with that. And he takes a lot of the ancient Egyptian culture, and he's an architect, but he looks at everything through this lens of sort of angle and design and whatnot, and how that actually through angle and design actually connects us to a lot of this unseen spectrum of different energies that we are not able to see through the five senses necessarily. Mm-hmm. Really fascinating work. But when he was talking about the where we kind of were to where we are now, and he talked about it from a perspective of right and left brains in some way, Gard, but he said, you know, originally there was no separation between the human being and the earth and nature. It was like we were very much a part of it, very much like animals in nature, like very much. It was, you couldn't separate it. And then as we started to, the left brain functions were coming online and we were exploring more of the individuality, then we started to kind of create a little bit of separation from it, but that we could still connect very much to it because we were aware of it, but we would connect through it through ritual, through prayer, through ceremony. These were sort of our sacred ways of then connecting back into that and having a reverence for it, tying back to divinity in many ways. And then as that carried on, we got way too skewed over where we've kind of taken that individual's part so much that we've now lost a lot of that right brain sort of aspect of it. And now we're in that process of sort of transitioning back. And this is where even the practices, you know, when I go through your book, you'll go through a teaching and then you give a very practical exercise that you can incorporate to have a tangible experience with it. This is a really beautiful part about, I think, what's happening right now is that, and why I think people are resonating with these teachings, because it's allowing people to come back to create that tangible experience with this, for lack of a better word, just this divine energy, whatever people kind of know there's something more.
Yeah, there are many ways to do this, Jason, obviously, too. And I've been writing these books and doing these workshops over 40 years or whatever, and, you know, chanting Aramaic with different melodies with people for the people who find that they have a heart feeling for this guy, you know, for Yeshua, for Jesus. And you don't have to be Christian to have that. You may have been raised Christian and rejected 90% of what they were telling you about it, but you still had a feeling in your heart, there's something there. That certainly was my experience. So the books and all these things, they're written to help people sort of shed some of this baggage. And I would maintain that even if people don't believe they have this baggage and they've totally gone off religion, you know, completely, that there's still a lot of this that impacted Western culture. to mention a few of the isms that developed from an interpretation of the Bible, we could mention colonialism, which is based on a misinterpretation of Genesis, that we should go out and dominate and subdue the earth. That's a false translation. And then if there's no human beings that are dominating and subduing the earth, we have the right to go and dominate and subdue them, like the native peoples, for instance. I mean, that's justified by a Christian theological view of a mistranslation of the Hebrew of Genesis, and that becomes colonialism. I'm not saying religion created it, but religion sort of propped it up. And then we can think about the split between the sexes, men and women, so-called, you know, racism, ecocide. All these things have been impacted by even a secular Western view that is based on a lot of these false notions about this guy Jesus.
Well, that's a good way to segue in. Go ahead, hon.
I was just going to ask, Neil, where is the place or the relevance of the heart in knowing Yeshua's teachings? I know that as Jason was reading some of the passages from your book out loud, I know the part of me that it really spoke to in a very tangible way was the heart. It felt so heartwarming and comforting, and it was just like I could feel the energy concentrating around the heart. Mystics and poets have spoken a lot about the heart as well. What did Yeshua say about the heart?
He has much to say about the heart, Taya, and thank you for sharing that, actually. For Jesus, the Aramaic word for heart is leba or lebha, and it really is that center point that you could say where my individual life and the life of everything and all the time, my soul life, comes together. Again, maps are sometimes divisive and overly simplistic, but it's as though, you know, my soul is much bigger than me and my individual life. But my individual life is also important. So the heart is where those come together. Aramaic doesn't actually even have a word for mind, as we would think of it today. It doesn't have a separation between what we call mind, body, soul, spirit. It doesn't have any of that. I mean, the word for spirit actually means breath in Aramaic, or even ancient Hebrew. So the breath was considered to be sacred. And feeling my breath in the heart with love, with courage, with thankfulness, dare I say with devotion, all these things are very, very important. And they're some of what he came to bring. He says he comes to give you life, life energy, and to give it much more abundantly than what you have. Even at Yeshua's time, these spiritual experiences of the heart, which we find cross-culturally in the ancient world, everywhere, as elsewhere, they had been, to use a word, they had been colonized by forms of religion. You know, the spiritual energy is used to empower, to fuel a religious organization, if you will. Now, these organizations change throughout the world. In different prophets come, prophetesses, you know, throughout the world history, throughout the world. But the isms that these become, or the anities, the inanities that these become, you know, these are like, you know, Jason was talking about the rituals. People, if you read the history of religions, they say, well, these religions invented so and so, such and such rituals. No, it wasn't that at all. The rituals, the chanting, the body awareness, the sacred dancing, these come first. They get colonized by all these different religious organizations that then develop, and then they start to worship the thing rather than the goal. The goal is to connect. The goal is to connect. Connect with each other, connect with all that is. Simple. But then the specific rituals become placed on an altar in some form. And I don't care if it's Christianity or Buddhism or any of the Hinduisms or any of these things, the attention gets placed on the thing, on the ritual, on the device, rather than what the device, so to speak, is for. And this is where we are now. That's why people are listening to this podcast and others like them, because they're breaking out of these things. And so we have people having mystical experiences all over the place without any prerequisite, shall we say, without having to go into a particular temple, church, you know, gurdwara or whatever, or Zen center or any of these things. Or if they have been, it wasn't helping. So then they had, you know, they went and had their own experiences. And that's just where we are now. And this is the good part, you see, Jason. This is where the evolution of the human self, of the individuality, is breaking through. It's starting to break through all of these ceilings that have been placed on us. And I don't just mean by organized religions. I mean also by, it can be by different spiritual groups, or people think, well, you know, just come join our group, then you'll be safe and we have the right thing and, you know, yada, 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 all that. So people are rejecting these things now, and I think it's just a natural trend.
The Inspire Health Podcast will be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Stop suffering with pet-related allergies when near dogs and cats. Great news, you can feel safe around pets with Nasal Guard for pet lovers. Nasal Guard topical gel blocks pet dander, hair, and dust mites from entering your nasal passages. Try Nasal Guard for pet lovers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Aunt and Deck, fish and chips, Mum and Dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, sorry, I'm going on a bit about
it. No, I think that was perfect. And even when you were talking about isms and some of these different things, I remember an author who I really enjoyed a lot of the teachings from was Dr. David Hawkins, and he did a whole scale on consciousness and had talked about that for quite a while. A really beautiful, beautiful person. And he would talk about, so he had kind of created a scale of consciousness that he could calibrate. And he would talk about some of the original avatars like Jesus who would come down with his original message would be at a absolute purity, be at like highest you can get, like 1,000 on the scale. And then as those messages got often interpreted by people that were not at the same level of consciousness, they weren't grasping, and it's almost like the broken telephone. It just gradually comes down more and more and more. And then a lot of times the bodies of the religions that take these messages are much less than what the original message of the actual avatar was that spoke them. So this is where I think then we get some of the misinterpretations. And then he also said when you actually attach ism to almost anything, it drops it right below the level of actual
right down adventure. Yeah, familiar with, I've seen David Hawkins scale. It's it's very useful. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. It's exactly right, you know.
So I thought that was fascinating. So Neil, what from your perspective, what are some of the, and I know there could be a lot, but from when you've gone through it, what were some of the teachings where when you actually started to interpret them through the Aramaic lens, where you're like, holy cow, like that says something so different than what it sounded like in when we just read it in English and the wording around it. What were some of the biggest, whether it was the Beatitudes that Jesus spoke about on the Sermon on the Mount, or the Lord's Prayer, again from the Sermon on the Mount, that really spoke to you, that were really valuable to share with people, that they maybe only got a portion of the full message, and there is so much more there for people to embrace.
Yeah, I know, it's hard to know where to begin. I mean, even the word prayer in Aramaic is basically equivalent to meditation in our language. So prayer doesn't necessarily mean saying words to someone up there or anywhere else. It can involve intoning words or sounds, but prayer is really a way of opening oneself to the larger reality. So although we talk about Jesus's prayer, the so-called Lord's Prayer, although he never called it that, that prayer, which I go through in the new book, is really a step-by-step meditation to open, find empowerment, you know, then make choices about our lives, learn or let awaken within us how to handle our human community, and then offer it all up back to the source. I mean, that's in 30 seconds, the whole prayer. It's much more subtle than that in Aramaic, but that's where basically it goes. That's very different than just saying, "Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name," etc., etc. The Beatitudes are similar. I mean, there's so much that's mistranslated in the Beatitudes. I'll just start with the first one. I mean, usually it's translated, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for they shall," I forgot, "they shall do something."
"They shall inherit the earth."
"Blessed are the poor in spirit. They, to them belongs the kingdom of heaven."
Right.
"Tubehun lemeskeni baruch tilhone malkuta deshmaya." The Aramaic says ripe, in the right time, at the right place. This is overall what Jesus uses as the word when you see good or blessed or blessed or however you want to pronounce it in the New Testament. Just cross that out and write ripe above it, at the right time, at the right place. And that means at the right time, at the right place with one's, you could say with one's soul or with one's sort of deeper self, as Jung would call it, the capital S self. You're in tune in time with what is yours to do in the big picture of life and with your surroundings. Then you'll be in a good place, he's saying. So tubehun lemeskeni baruch, ripe, blessedly ripe are those who, guess what, who find their home in their breath, in their breathing. Because the word lemeskeni implies that the breath is our first and our last possession. So the image is though almost as though, okay, at this moment, I realize that breathing is really all I have. It was my first, you know, gift when I came into this body, when I left my mother's womb, and it will be the last thing that departs when I leave this body, which is a gift of discovery. So he says, if you realize that your breath is your first and last possession, that's your starting place for entering this big, 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 big universe, Dilhone Malkuta Deshmaya, and not just a universe, but a universe that says and resonates with the words, "I can," that is with vision, with power, with purpose. So purpose is very important in Jesus's teaching, and he links it to breath. So that here we have this word kingdom, which is used all over the New Testament, the kingdom of this, that, and the other thing. It really should really be queendom, because the Aramaic, as well as actually the Greek when I looked it up, are feminine gendered, but the translators just made it masculine because that's what they did at those times, and even now, because they can't see it otherwise. This "I can," this resonance, this, you could say, this fiery choice, this sense of purpose is ringing through the whole universe. It's not like we're alone with our own little, you know, sense of purpose and success and failure and all that. No, my purpose, when I really touch it, you know, even if it's just for the moment, is part of this much, much bigger heart of the cosmos. And then the Beatitudes also go on from there and there. And, you know, we start with breathing, and then the Beatitudes in Matthew, they're going, okay, then we breathe deeper, we feel the breath lower, we breathe into what is confused in us, what is mourning, you know, and then we breathe even further down, we feel our belly and what he calls womb, which is the source of the word of this deeper radiant love. That's why you have the same word meaning womb, W-O-M-B, woman's womb, and love. It's the roots of one of the deepest words for love in the Semitic languages. So if we go way, way down deep, then we're going to find this very deep love that wells up from us. And then then it clarifies our vision. We can see clearly what is ours to do. And then we plant peace, and it goes on and on like that. So again, I've given you a 30-second, maybe a one-minute gloss on the Beatitudes, but again, there's much more on this in the new book. It's also full of not the book, but Yeshua's teachings. That's the book is good too, but Yeshua's teachings in Aramaic are so full of wonderful things. I mean, the important thing for your listeners to realize, or if they're reviewing, is also, I was raised as a child, and they said, you know, believe in Jesus and that'll save your soul. But Jesus never asked us to believe in him. Mm-hmm. He asked us to, if you look at the preposition in Aramaic, actually in Greek too, I looked at it because I learned a bit of Greek to do the new book. He says, believe like me, believe as though you're within me. Have the same trust that I have, that this is one reality that we all share. So it's not believe concepts about me. He never asked people to do that. And he didn't say we need to save our soul. He says really much more, we need to let our soul save us. We need to let our soul, that is our rucha, the big breaths, soul, self, save, redeem us, that is help us fulfill our purpose for being here in these bodies for however many years we get. And, you know, it turns the whole thing on its head. And these are some of the most, you know, radical things I found over the last 40 years. And I still get enthused about them, as you can tell. It's very, very important now for people to hear this.
Well, yeah, it's beautiful.
They're also incredibly empowering, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I think that word gets so misoverused, empowering. And I think it actually gets flipped in a lot of ways too, what people think is empowering. But I mean, so much of what Jesus does is point back to ourselves, to have to kind of go back in, wrestle with the own stuff, or sit with it, breathe with it. And, you know, what I love about the word ripeness, because that doesn't come up. You don't see that word ripeness coming up in a lot of just traditional passages, but that sits so much. It feels so nice inside myself, because it feels like within that concept of ripeness, there's no one specific thing you can hang your hat on. You know, it's like you have to come back, and the time is always changing depending on where you are, depending on what's going on. There's a self-reflective nature around that, where we are constantly in this impermanence, that things are always changing, and it's going back in, and it feels like then allowing our own knowing and personal instructions to surface to then act spontaneously when the moment is ripe. And we will know it by going back inside and finding it ourselves. It's not like you're putting your authority to something outside of you to give you the answer. It's constantly causing you, or asking you, to come back and find it within and nurture that. That to me feels very different than a lot of what I usually hear. Because even when you were talking about believe, that comes up a lot. The other word that comes up a lot is followers, and to follow. And I feel like even that concept has a different meaning, because the word follow feels like you're handing over a little bit to somebody else. From that perspective, how would you interpret follow then when you hear that?
I interpret it in the ancient sort of Semitic way, where that, you know, we get to choose who are guides, who we emulate, who we learn from. Perhaps when we're children, if we're fortunate, we have, when we're learning language, for instance, we imitate our parents or whoever is in our surrounding, and we learn language. We learn to speak not from a book or not from an intellectual presentation, but simply from hearing and imitating and sounding and all of this. So when we're younger, hopefully we have, you know, good models to imitate. But then, you know, very quickly, as we say, as we're reborn, we're born into a new sense of self, which usually occurs at various times throughout our life. then we are more and more empowered. And how do we say? Well, we're responsible for making our own choices, rather than give those choices over to some authority, whether political, religious, or otherwise. And this is difficult for people, because people want to have the security, sense of safety of, you know, connecting in a group and all of these things. And it doesn't mean we can't do this, but we still need to own our own, you could say, authority of making these choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's where I went with it anyway.
Yeah, it's very much how it lands for me too. I feel like they're not exclusive. It's like you can still kind of have all of it. It's not that there's not aspects of external authority, but it's almost like everything still is being asked to run through yourself.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, very, and, very much so. And as I say, as we were talking about, whatever, 20 minutes or so ago, this is now where human consciousness is. This is where we are. It has its terrible sides. Absolutely. We see some of the bad choices all around us. But at the same time, this is the potential. The potential is to make proper choices. This reminds me of a line toward the end of Yeshua's prayer, the so-called Lord's Prayer, where it's usually translated, "Do not lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." I'm forgetting my King James Version here. Mm-hmm. Blotted it out. So, it says, "Lead us not into temptation." Well, that was terrible when I was a children. Why is God leading us into temptation? What's going on here? And no one wants to answer this question. Well, you know, there was Egypt and the Pharaoh and yada yada and on and on. But you know, they do double backflips to try to explain this theologically. Well, the simple thing is, it was a mistranslation, not a limited translation. It's a mistranslation. And it should say, "Lead us not into, let us not enter, do not let us enter temptation." But temptation actually just means forgetfulness in Aramaic, nisiyuna. And this means forgetfulness of who we are, where we came from in the bigger sense, and where we're going.
This comes to the end of our time for this episode. Please go to inspirehealthpodcast.com and listen to the remainder of this important episode. Thank you so much.